In this you must trust me. I'm the architect of his current troubles. I assure you, I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his. But it won't be me that he'll speak to. It will be you, the Thorn of Camor, the greatest mummer this city has ever produced. You, cast in the role of me, just for one night, a virtuoso performance. A command performance? Why? I will be required elsewhere at that time. The conference is one part of a wider concern. I am personally known to Kappa Borsavi and his entire family. You have already convinced the Salvaras that you were two different men. In the same day, no less. I'll coach you in what I wish you to say, and provide you with a suitable wardrobe. Between your skills and my current anonymity, no one will ever be aware that you are even involved, or that you are not the real Grey King. An amusing plan. It has balls, and that appeals to me. But you do realize that I'm going to look like quite the ass, said Locke, when the Kappa opens our conversation with a dozen crossbow bolts to my chest. Hardly an issue. You'll be quite well protected against routine foolishness on the Kappa's part. I'll be sending the Falconer with you. Locke flicked his gaze back to the bondsmage, who smiled with obvious mock magnanimity. "Do you really think," continued the Grey King, "that I would have let you keep that other stiletto in your coat sleeve if any weapon in your hands could touch me? Try to cut me. I'll let you borrow a crossbow or two if you like. A quarrel will do no better. The same protection will be yours when you meet with the Kappa." "Then it's true," said Locke. "Those stories aren't just stories. Your pet mage gives you more than just the ability to make my brain lock up like I've been drinking all night." "Yes, and it was my men who started spreading those stories for one purpose. I wanted Barsavi's gangs to so dread my presence that they wouldn't dare to get close to you when the time came for you to speak to him. After all, I have the power to kill men with a touch." The Grey King smiled. "And when you're me, so will you." Locke frowned. That smile, that face, there was something damned familiar about the Grey King. Nothing immediately obvious, just a nagging sensation that Locke had been in his presence before. He cleared his throat. "That's very thoughtful of you. And what happens when I finish this task for you?" "A parting of the ways," said the Grey King. "You to your business and me to my own." "I find that somewhat difficult to believe." "You'll leave your meeting with Barsavi alive, Locke. Fear not for what happens after that. I assure you it won't be as bad as you think. If I merely wanted to assassinate him, can you deny that I could have done it long ago?"
"You've killed 7 of his garistas. You've kept him locked away on the floating grave for months."
"Not as bad as I think. He killed 8 of his own full crowns after Tesso died. He won't accept less than blood from you." "Barsavi has kept himself locked away on the floating grave, Locke. And as I said, you must trust me to deal with that end of the situation. The Kappa will acquiesce to what I have to offer him. We'll settle the question of Camor once and for all, to everyone's satisfaction."
"I grant that you're dangerous," said Locke, "but you must be mad."
"Suit whatever meaning you wish to my actions, Locke, provided that you perform as required."
"It would appear," Locke said sourly, "that I have no choice."
"This is no accident. Are we agreed? You'll perform this task for me?"
"With instruction in what you wish me to say to Kappa Barsavi?" Yes. There will be one other condition.
Really?
If I'm going to do this for you, said Locke, I need to have a way to speak to you, or at least get a message to you at my own will. Something may come up which can't wait for you to prance around, appearing out of nowhere.
It's unlikely, said the Grey King.
It's a necessity. Do you want me to be successful in this task or not?
Very well, the Grey King nodded. Falconer.
The falconer rose from his seat. Vestris never took her eyes from Locke's. The hawk's master reached inside his coat with his free hand and withdrew a candle, a tiny cylinder of white wax with an odd smear of crimson swirling through it.
"Light this," said the bondsmage, "in a place of solitude. You must be absolutely alone. Speak my name, and I will hear and come soon enough."
"Thank you." Locke took the candle with his right hand and slipped it into his own coat. "Falconer. Easy to remember, that." Vestris opened her beak, but made no noise. It snapped shut, and the bird blinked. A yawn? Her version of a chuckle at Locke's expense?
"I'll be keeping an eye on you," said the bondsmage. "Just as Vestris feels what I feel, I see what she sees."
"That explains quite a bit," said Locke.
"If we are agreed," said the Grey King, "our business here is finished. I have something else to do, and it must be done tonight. Thank you, Master Thorne, for seeing reason,"
said the man with the crossbow to the man with the money purse. Locke stood up and slipped his left hand into a coat pocket. The forearm was still throbbing with pain. "So when is this meeting supposed to take place?"
3 nights hence," said the Grey King. "No interruption at all for your Don Salvara game, I trust?"
"I don't think you really care, but no."
"All for the better, then. Let us return you to your own affairs."
"You're not going to..." But it was too late. The falconer had already begun to gesture with his free hand and move his lips, forming words but not quite vocalizing them. The room spun. The orange lantern light became a fading streak of color against the darkness of the room, and then there was only darkness. 6. When Locke's senses returned, he found himself standing on the bridge between the snare and Coin Kisser's Row. Not a moment had passed, by his own personal reckoning, but when he looked up he saw that the clouds were gone, the stars had whirled in the dark sky, and the moons were low in the west.
"Son of a bitch," he hissed. "It's been hours. Jean's going to be having fits."
He thought quickly. Carlo and Galdo had planned to spend the evening making their rounds in the snare, with Bug in tow. They would probably have ended up at the last mistake, dicing and drinking and trying not to get thrown out for card sharping. Jean had intended to spend the night feigning occupancy in the broken tower rooms, at least until Locke returned. That would be the closest place to begin hunting for them. Just then Locke remembered that he was still dressed as Lucas Fairwhite. He slapped his forehead. He pulled his coat and cravats off, yanked the false optics from the bridge of his nose, and stuffed them in a vest pocket. He gingerly felt the cuts on his left arm. They were deep and still painful, but the blood had crusted on them, so at least he wasn't dripping all over the place. "God's damn the Grey King," thought Locke, "and God's grant I get the chance to balance this night out in the ledger." He ruffled his hair, unbuttoned his vest, untucked his shirt, and reached down to fold and conceal the ridiculous ribbon tongues of his shoes. His cravats and his decorative belts went into the coat, which Locke then folded up and tied by the sleeves. In the darkness it bore an excellent resemblance to a plain old cloth sack. With the outward flourishes of Lucas Fairwhite broken down, he could at least pass without notice for a reasonably short period of time. Satisfied, he turned and began to walk quickly down the south side of the bridge, toward the still lively lights and noises of the snare. Jean Tannen actually appeared from an alley and took him by the arm as he turned onto the street on the north side of the broken tower, where the main entrance to the last mistake opened onto the cobbles.
"Locke, where the hell have you been all night? Are you well?"
"Jean, gods, am I ever glad to see you? I'm far from well, as are you. Where are the others?"
"When you didn't return," Jean said, speaking in a low voice close to Locke's ear, "I found them in the last mistake and sent them up to our rooms with Bug. I've been pacing the alleys down here, trying to keep out of sight. I didn't want us all getting scattered across the city by night. We feared..."
"I was taken, Jean, but then I was let go. Let's get up to the rooms. We have a new problem, fresh from the oven and hot as hell."
7. They let the windows in their rooms stay open this time, with thin sheets of translucent mesh drawn down to keep out biting insects. The sky was turning grey, with lines of red visible just beneath the eastern windowsills, when Locke finished relating the events of the night. His listeners had shadows beneath their bleary eyes, but none showed any indication of sleepiness just then.
"At least we know now," Locke finished, "that he won't be trying to kill me like he did the other Garistas."
"Not until 3 nights hence, anyway," said Galdo.
"Bastards simply can't be trusted," said Bug.
"But for the time being," said Locke, "he must be obeyed."
Locke had changed into spare clothes. He now looked much more suitably low class. Jean had insisted on washing his arm with reinforced wine, heated to near boiling on an alchemical hearthstone. Locke now had a compress of brandy-soaked cloth pressed to it, and he bathed it in the light of a small white glow-globe. It was common knowledge among the physicians of Camor that light drove back malodorous air and helped prevent lingering infections.
"Must he?" Carlos scratched a stubbly chin. "How far do you figure we can get if we run like hell?"
"From the Grey King? Who knows?" Locke sighed. "From the Bondsmage, not far enough, ever."
"So we just sit back," said Jean, "and let him pull your strings like a marionette on stage."
"I was rather taken," said Locke, "with the whole idea of him not telling Kappa Barsavi about our confidence games, yes." "This whole thing is mad," said Galdo. "You said you saw 3 rings on this falconer's wrist?"
"The one that didn't have the damn scorpion hawk, yeah."
3 rings, Jean muttered. "It is mad. To keep one of those people in service. It must be 2 months now since the first stories of the Grey King appeared. Since the first Garista got it. Who was it again?"
"Gil the Cutter, from the Rumhounds," said Carlo.
"The coin involved has to be ludicrous. I doubt the Duke could keep a bondsmage of rank on for this long. So who the fuck is this Grey King, and how is he paying for this?"
"Immaterial," said Locke. 3 nights hence, or 2.5 now that the sun's coming up, there'll be 2 Grey Kings... and I'll be one of them."
13, said Jean. He put his head in his hands and rubbed his eyes with his palms.
"So that's the bad news. Kappa Barsavi wants me to marry his daughter, and now the Grey King wants me to impersonate him at a secret meeting with Kappa Barsavi."
Locke grinned.
"The good news is I didn't get any blood on that new promissory note for 4,000 crowns.
"I'll kill him," said Bug. "Get me poisoned quarrels and an alley piece, and I'll drill him in the eyes."
"Bug," said Locke, "that makes leaping off a temple roof sound reasonable by comparison."
"But who would ever expect it?"
Bug, sitting beneath one of the room's eastern windows, turned his head to stare out it for a few moments, as he had been intermittently doing all night.
"Look, everyone knows that one of you 4 could kill them. But nobody would expect me. Total surprise. 1 shot in the face. No more Grey King."
"Assuming the falconer allowed your crossbow bolts to hit his client," said Locke, "he would probably cook us where we stood right after that. Also, I very much doubt that fucking bird is going to be fluttering around this tower where we can see it."
"You never know," said Bug. "I think I saw it before, when we made first touch on Don Salvara."
"I'm pretty sure I did, too."
Carlo was knuckle-walking a Solon on his left hand without looking at it.
"While I was strangling you, Locke, something flew overhead. Damn big and fast for a wren or a sparrow."
"So," said Jean, "he really has been watching us, and he really knows all there is to know about us. Knuckling under might be wiser for the time being, but we've got to have some contingencies we can cook up."
"Should we call off the Don Salvara game now?" asked Bug meekly.
"Hmm? No."
Locke shook his head vigorously. "There's absolutely no reason, for the time being."
"How," said Galdo, "do you figure that?"
"The reason we discussed shortening the game was to keep our heads down and try to avoid getting killed by the Grey King. Now we can be pretty damn sure that won't happen, at least not for 3 days. So the Salvara game stays in play."
"For 3 days, yes, until the Grey King has no further use for you."
Jean spat. "Next step in whatever the plans are. Thanks for your cooperation. Here's a complimentary knife in the back for all of you."
"It's a possibility," said Locke. "So what we do is this. Jean, you scuttle around today after you've had some sleep. Cancel those arrangements for sea travel. If we need to run, waiting for a ship to put out will take too long. Likewise, drop more gold at the Viscount's gate. If we go out, we go out by land. And I want that gate swinging wider and faster than a whorehouse door. Carlo, Galdo, you find us a wagon. Stash it behind the temple. Set it up with tarps and rope for fast packing. Get us food and drink for the road. Simple stuff, sturdy stuff. Spare cloaks, plain clothing. You know what to do. If any right people spot you at work, maybe drop a hint that we're after a fat score in the next few days. Barsavi would like that, if it gets back to him. Bug, tomorrow you and I are going to go through the vault. We'll bring up every coin in there, and we're going to pack them in canvas sacks for easy transport. If we have to run, I want to be able to throw the whole mess on the back of our wagon in just a few minutes."
"Makes sense," said Bug.
"So, Sansas, you stick together," said Locke. "Bug, you're with me. Nobody goes it alone for any length of time except Jean. You're the least likely to get troubled, if the Grey King's got anything less than an army hidden in the city."
"Oh, you know me." Jean reached behind his neck, down behind the loose leather vest he wore over his simple cotton tunic. He withdrew a pair of matching hatchets, each a foot and a half in length, with leather-wrapped handles and straight black blades that narrowed like scalpels. These were balanced with balls of blackened steel, each as wide around as a silver Solon. The Wicked Sisters, Jean's weapons of choice.
"I never travel alone. It's always the three of us."
"Right then,"
Locke yawned.
"If we need any other bright ideas, we can conjure them when we wake up. Let's set something heavy against the door, shut the windows, and start snoring."
The gentleman bastards had just stumbled to their feet to begin putting this sensible plan into action when Jean held up one hand for silence. The stairs outside the door on the north wall of the chamber were creaking under the weight of many feet. A moment later, someone was banging on the door itself.
"Lamora!" came a loud male voice. "Open up! Copper's business!"
Jean slipped his hatchets into one hand and put that hand behind his back, then stood against the north wall, a few feet to the right of the door. Carlo and Galdo reached under their shirts for their daggers, Galdo pushing Bug back behind him as they did so. Locke stood in the center of the room, remembering that his stilettos were still wrapped up in his fair white coat.
"What's the price of a loaf?" he shouted. "At the shifting market!"
"One copper flat, but the loaves ain't dry," came the response.
Locke untensed just a bit. That was this week's proper greeting and countersign, and if they'd been coming to haul him off for anything bloody, well, they'd have simply kicked in the door. Signalling with his hands for everyone to stay calm,
He drew out the bolt and slid the front door open just wide enough to peek out. There were four men on the platform outside his door, 70 feet in the air above the last mistake. The sky was the color of murky canal water behind them, with just a few twinkling stars vanishing slowly here and there. They were hard-looking men, standing ready and easy like trained fighters, wearing leather tunics, leather collars, and red cloth bandanas under black leather caps. Red Hands, the gang Barsavi turned to when he needed muscle work, and he needed it fast.
"Begging your pardon, brother."
The apparent leader of the Red Hands put one arm up against the door.
"Big man wants to see Locke Lamora right this very moment, and he don't care what state he's in, and he won't let us take no for an answer."
Interlude. Jean Tannen. 1. In the year that followed, Locke grew, but not as much as he would have liked. Although it was difficult to guess his true age with any hope of accuracy, it was obvious that he was more than a little runty for it.
"You missed a few meals in your very early years," Chains told him. "You've done much better since you came here, to be sure, but I suspect you'll always be a bit on the medium side."
"Always?"
"Don't be too upset." Chains put his hands on his own round belly and chuckled. "A little man can slip out of a pinch that a greater man might find inescapable."
There was further schooling. More sums, more history, more maps, more languages. Once Locke and the Sanzas had a firm grasp of conversational Vardran, Chains began having them instructed in the art of accents. A few hours each week were spent in the company of an old Vardran sailmender who would chide them for their fumble-mouthed mangling of the northern tongue while he drove his long wicked needles through yard upon yard of folded canvas. They would chat about any subject on the old man's mind, and he would fastidiously correct every consonant that was too short and every vowel that was too long. He would also get steadily more red-faced and belligerent as each session went on, for Chains paid him in wine for his services. There were trials, some trivial and some quite harsh. Chains tested his boys constantly, almost ruthlessly, but when he was finished with each new conundrum, he always took them to the temple roof to explain what he'd wanted, what the hardship signified. His openness after the fact made his games easier to bear, and they had the added effect of uniting Locke, Carlo, and Galdo against the world around them. The more Chains tightened the screws, the closer the boys grew, the more smoothly they worked together, the less they had to say out loud to set a plan in motion. The coming of Jean Tannen changed all that. It was the month of Saris in the 77th year of Yono, the end of an unusually dry and cool autumn. Storms had lashed the iron sea but spared Camor by some trick of the winds or the gods, and the nights were finer than any in Locke's living memory. He was sitting the steps with Father Chains, flexing his fingers, eagerly awaiting the rise of false light, when he spotted the thief-maker walking across the square toward the house of Perelandro. 2 years had removed some of the dread Locke had once felt toward his former master, but there was no denying that the skinny old fellow retained a certain grotesque magnetism. The thief-maker's spindly fingers spread as he bowed from the waist, and his eyes lit up when they seized on Locke.
"My dear bedeviling little boy, what a pleasure it is to see you leading a productive life in the Order of Perelandro."
"He owes his success to your early discipline, of course."
Chain's smile spread beneath his blindfold.
"It's what helped to make him the resolute and morally upright youth he is today."
"Upright?"
The thief-maker squinted at Locke, feigning concentration.
"I'd be hard-pressed to say he's grown an inch. But no matter. I've brought you the boy we discussed, the one from the north corner. Step forward, Jean. You can't hide behind me any more than you could hide under a copper coin."
There was indeed a boy standing behind the thief-maker. When the old man shooed him out into plain view, Locke saw that he was about his own age, perhaps 10, and in every other respect his opposite. The new boy was fat, red-faced, shaped like a dirty pear with a greasy mop of black hair atop his head. His eyes were wide and shocked. He clenched and unclenched his soft hands nervously.
"Ah," said Chains. "Ah! I can't see him, but then the qualities the Lord of the Overlooked desires in his servants cannot be seen by any man. Are you penitent, my boy? Are you sincere? Are you as upright as those our charitable celestial master has already taken into his fold?"
He gave Locke a pat on the back, manacles and chains rattling. Locke, for his part, stared at the newcomer and said nothing.
"I hope so, sir," said Jean, in a voice that was soft and haunted.
"Well," said the thief-maker, "hope is what we all build lives for ourselves upon, is it not? The good Father Chains is your master now, boy. I leave you to his care."
"Not mine, but that of the higher power I serve," said Chains. "Oh, before you leave, I just happened to find this purse sitting on my temple steps earlier today."
He held out a fat little leather bag stuffed with coins and waved it in the thief-maker's general direction.
"Is it yours, by chance?"
"Why, so it is, so it is."
The thief-maker plucked the purse from Chain's hands and made it vanish into the pockets of his weather-eaten coat.
"What a fortunate coincidence that is!"
He bowed once more, turned, and began to walk back in the direction of Shades Hill, whistling tunelessly. Chains arose, rubbed his legs, and clapped his hands.
"Let us call an end to our public duties for the day. Jean, this is Locke Lamora, one of my initiates. Please help him carry this kettle into the sanctuary. Careful, it's heavy."
The thin boy and the fat boy heaved the kettle up the steps and into the damp sanctuary. The eyeless priest groped along his chains, gathering the slack and dragging it with him until he was safely inside. Locke worked the wall mechanism to slide the temple doors shut, and Chains settled himself down in the middle of the sanctuary floor.
"The kindly gentleman," said Chains, "who delivered you into my care, said that you could speak, read, and write in 3 languages.
"Yes, sir," said Jean, gazing around him in trepidation. "Therin, Vadran, and Isavrai."
"Very good. And you can do complex sums? Ledger balancing?"
"Yes."
"Excellent. Then you can help me count the day's takings. But first, come over here and give me your hand. That's it. Let us see if you have any of the gifts necessary to become an initiate of this temple, Jean Tannen."
What must I do?"
"Simply place your hands on my blindfold. No, stand easy. Close your eyes. Concentrate. Let whatever virtuous thoughts you have within you bubble to the surface."
2.
"I don't like him," said Locke. "I don't like him at all."
He and Chains were preparing the breakfast meal early the next morning. Locke was simmering up a soup from sliced onions and irregular little brown cubes of reduced beef stock, while Chains was attempting to crack the wax seal on a honey crock. His bare fingers and nails having failed, he was hacking at it with a stiletto and muttering to himself.
"Don't like him at all?"
"That's rather silly," said Chains, his voice distant, "since he's not yet been here a single day."
"He's fat. He's soft. He's not one of us."
"He most certainly is. We showed him the temple and the burrow. He took oath as my pezon. I'll go see the copper with him in just a day or two."
I don't mean one of us, gentlemen bastards. I mean one of us, us. He's not a thief. He's a soft, fat...
Merchant. Son of merchant parents is what he is. But he's a thief now.
He didn't steal things. He didn't charm or tease. He said he was in the hill for a few days before he got brought here. So he's not one of us.
Locke. Chains turned from the business of the honeycrock and stared down at him, frowning. Jean Tannon is a thief because I'm going to train him as a thief. You do recall that's what I train here, thieves of a very particular sort. This hasn't slipped your mind?
But he's...
He's better learned than any of you. Scribes in a clean, smooth hand. Understands business, ledgers, money shifts, and a great many other things. Your former master knew I'd want him right away.
He's fat.
So am I. And you're ugly. Carlo and Galdo have noses like siege engines. Sabatha had spots breaking out last we saw her. Did you have a point?
He kept us up all night. He was crying, and he wouldn't shut up.
I'm sorry, said a soft voice from behind them. Locke and Chains turned, the latter much more slowly than the former. Jean Tannon was standing by the door to the sleeping quarters, red-eyed.
I didn't mean to. I couldn't help it.
Ha! Chains turned back to his stiletto and his honeycrock. Looks as though boys who live in glass burrows shouldn't speak so loudly of those in the next room.
Well, don't do it again, Jean, said Locke, hopping down from the wooden step he still used to reach the top of the cooking hearth.
He crossed to one of the spice cabinets and began shuffling jars, looking for something.
Shut up and let us sleep. Carlo and Galdo and I don't blubber.
I'm sorry, said Jean, sounding close to tears again.
I'm sorry, it's just... My mother... My father, I'm an orphan. So what?
Locke took down a little glass bottle of pickled radishes, sealed with a stone stopper like an alchemical potion.
I'm an orphan. We're all orphans here. Whining won't make your family live again.
Locke turned and took two steps back toward the cooking hearth, so he didn't see Jean cross the space between them. He did feel Jean's arm wrap around his neck from behind. It might have been soft, but it was damned heavy for a 10-year-old. Locke lost his grip on the pickled radishes. Jean picked him off the ground by main force, whirled and heaved him. Locke's feet left the ground at the same time the radish jar shattered against it. A confused second later, the back of Locke's head bounced off the heavy witchwood dining table, and he fell to the ground, landing painfully on his rather bony posterior.
You shut up!
There was nothing subdued about Jean now. He was screaming, red-faced, with tears pouring out of his eyes.
You shut your filthy mouth! You never talk about my family!
Locke put up his hands and tried to stand up. One of Jean's fists grew in his field of vision until it seemed to blot out half the world. The blow folded him over like a bread pretzel. When he recovered something resembling his senses, he was hugging a table leg. The room was dancing a minuet around him. He said, his mouth full of blood and pain. Now, Jean, said Chains, pulling the heavy-set boy away from Locke, I think your message is rather thoroughly delivered.
Oh, that really hurt, said Locke.
It's only fair. Chains released Jean, who balled his fists and stood glaring at Locke, shuddering. You really deserved it.
Huh, what?
Sure we're all orphans here. My parents were long dead before you were even born. Your parents are years gone. Same for Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha. But Jean, said Chains, lost his only 5 nights ago.
Oh,
Locke sat up, groaning.
I didn't know.
Well, then. Chains finally succeeded in prying open the honeycrock. The wax seals split with an audible crack.
When you don't know everything you could know, it's a fine time to shut your fucking noisemaker and be polite.
It was a fire.
Jean took a few deep breaths, still staring at Locke.
They burned to death. The whole shop. Everything gone.
He turned and walked back to the sleeping quarters, head down, rubbing at his eyes. Chains turned his back on Locke and began stirring the honey, breaking up the little patches of crystallization. There was an echoing clang from the fall of the secret door that led down from the temple above. A moment later, Carlo and Galdo appeared in the kitchen, each twin dressed in his white initiate's robe, each one balancing a long, soft loaf of bread atop his head.
"We have returned," said Carlo. "With bread." "Which is obvious." "No, you're obvious."
The twins stopped short when they saw Locke pulling himself up by the edge of the table, lips swollen, blood trickling from the corners of his mouth.
"What did we miss?"
asked Galdo.
"Boys," said Chains, "I might have forgotten to tell you something when I introduced you to Jean and showed him around last night. Your old master from Shades Hill warned me that while Jean is mostly soft-spoken, the boy has one hell of a colourful temper."
Shaking his head, Chains stepped over to Locke and helped him stand upright.
"When the world stops spinning," he said, "don't forget that you've got broken glass and radishes to clean up, too."
3. Locke and Jean maintained a healthy distance from one another at the dinner table that night, saying nothing. Carlo and Galdo exchanged exasperated looks approximately several hundred times per minute, but made no attempts at conversation themselves. Preparations for the meal were conducted in near silence, with Chains apparently happy to oblige his sullen crew. Once Locke and Jean had seated themselves at the table, Chains set a carved ivory box down before each of them. The boxes were about a foot long and a foot wide, with hinged covers. Locke immediately recognized them as determiner's boxes, delicate Ferrari devices that used clockwork, sliding tiles, and rotating wooden knobs to enable a trained user to rapidly conduct certain mathematical operations. He'd been taught the basics of the device, but it had been months since he'd last used one.
"Locke and Jean," said Father Chains, "if you would be so kind. I have 995 Camori Solons, and I am taking ship for Tal Verar. I should very much like to have them converted to Solari when I arrive, the Solari currently being worth, 4/5 of one Camori full crown. How many Solari will the changers owe me before their fee is deducted?"
Jean immediately flipped open the lid on his box and set to work, fiddling knobs, flicking tiles, and sliding little wooden rods back and forth. Locke, flustered, followed suit. His own nervous fiddlings with the machine were nowhere near fast enough, for Jean shortly announced,
31 full Solari, with about 9/100 of one left over."
He stuck out the tip of his tongue and calculated for a few more seconds.
4 silver Volani and 2 coppers."
"Marvelous," said Chains. "Jean, you can eat this evening. Locke, I'm afraid you're out of luck. Thank you for trying, nonetheless. You may spend dinner in your quarters, if you wish."
"What?"
Locke felt the blood rushing to his cheeks.
"But that's not how it worked before. You always gave us individual problems, and I haven't used this box for..."
"Would you like another problem, then?"
"Yes."
"Very well. Jean, would you indulge us by doing it as well? Now, a Gerishti galleon sails the Iron Sea, and her captain is quite the penitent fellow. Every hour on the hour he has a sailor throw a loaf of ship's biscuit into the sea as an offering to Yono. Each loaf weighs 14 ounces. The captain is a remarkably neat fellow as well. The captain keeps his biscuit in casks, 1/4 ton apiece.
He sails for 1 week even. How many casks does he open? And how much biscuit does the lord of the grasping waters get? Again the boys worked their boxes, and again Jean looked up while Locke, little beads of sweat clearly visible on his little forehead, was still working.
"He only opens one cask," Jean said, "and he uses 147 pounds of biscuit."
Father Chains clapped softly. "Very good, Jean. You'll still be eating with us tonight. As for you, Locke, well, I shall call you when the clearing up needs to be done."
"This is ridiculous," Locke huffed. "He works the box better than I do. You set this up for me to lose."
"Ridiculous, is it? You've been putting on airs recently, my dear boy. You've reached that certain age where many boys seem to just sort of fold up their better judgment and set it aside for a few years. Hell, Sabbatha's done it too. Part of the reason I sent her off to where she is at the moment. Anyhow, it seems to me that your nose is tilting a little high in the air for someone with a death mark around his throat."
Locke's blush deepened. Jean snuck a furtive glance at him. Carlo and Galdo, who already knew about the shark's tooth, stared fixedly at their empty plates and glasses.
"The world is full of conundrums that will tax your skills. Do you presume that you will always get to choose the ones that best suit your strengths? If I wanted to send a boy to impersonate a money-changer's apprentice, who do you think I'd give the job to, if I had to choose between yourself and Jean? It's no choice at all."
"I suppose..."
"You suppose too much. You deride your new brother because his figure aspires to the noble girth of my own."
Chains rubbed his stomach and grinned mirthlessly.
"Didn't it ever occur to you that he fits in some places even better than you do because of it? Jean looks like a merchant's son, like a well-fed noble, like a plump little scholar. His appearance could be as much an asset to him as yours is to you."
"I guess."
"And if you needed any further demonstration that he can do things you cannot, well, why don't I instruct him to wallop the shit out of you one more time?"
Locke attempted to spontaneously shrink down inside his tunic and vanish into thin air. Failing, he hung his head.
"I'm sorry," said Jean. "I hope I didn't hurt you badly."
"You don't need to be sorry," Locke mumbled. "I suppose I really did deserve it."
"The threat of an empty stomach soon rekindles wisdom." Chains smirked. "Hardships are arbitrary, Locke. You never know which particular quality in yourself or a fellow is going to get you past them. For example, raise your hands if your surname happens to be Sansa."
Carlo and Galdo did so, a bit hesitantly.
"Anyone with the surname Sansa," said Chains, "may join our new brother Jean Tannen in dining this evening."
"I love being used as an example," said Galdo.
"Anyone with the surname Lamora," said Chains, "may eat, but first he will serve forth all the courses and attend on Jean Tannen."
So Locke scuttled about, embarrassment and relief mingled on his face. The meal was roasted capons stuffed with garlic and onions, with grapes and figs scalded in a hot wine sauce on the side. Father Chains poured all of his usual prayer toasts, dedicating the last to Jean Tannen, who lost one family but came to another soon enough. At that, Jean's eyes watered, and the boy lost whatever good cheer the food had brought to him. Noticing this, Carlo and Galdo took action to salvage his mood.
"That was really good, what you did with the box," said Carlo. "None of us can work it that fast," said Galdo. "And we're good with sums." "Or at least," said Galdo, "we thought we were, until we met you."
"It was nothing," said Jean. "I can be even faster.
I meant to say... He looked nervously at Father Chains before continuing.
I need optics, reading optics, for things up close. I can't see right without them. I could work a box even faster if I had them, but I lost mine. One of the boys in Shades Hill...
You shall have new ones, said Chains. Tomorrow or the next day. Don't wear them in public. It might contravene our air of poverty, but you can certainly wear them in here.
You couldn't even see straight, asked Locke. When you beat me? I could see a little bit, said Jean. It's all sort of blurry. That's why I was leaning back so far.
A mathematical terror, mused Father Chains, and a capable little brawler. What an interesting combination the benefactor has given the gentleman bastards in young Master Tannen. And he is a gentleman bastard, isn't he, Locke?
Yes, said Locke. I suppose he is.
4. The next night was clear and dry. All the moons were up, shining like sovereigns in the blackness with the stars for their court. Jean Tannen sat beneath one parapet wall on the temple roof, a book held out before him at arm's length. 2 oil lamps in glass boxes sat beside him, outlining him in warm yellow light.
"I don't mean to bother you,"
said Locke, and Jean looked up, startled.
"Gods, you're quiet!"
"Not all the time." Locke stepped to within a few feet of the larger boy.
"I can be very loud when I'm being stupid." Can I sit?"
Jean nodded, and Locke plopped down beside him. He folded his legs and wrapped his arm around his knees.
"I am sorry," said Locke. "I guess I really can be a shit sometimes." "I'm sorry, too. I didn't mean... When I hit you, it just... I'm not myself when I'm angry." "You did right. I didn't know about your mother and your father. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have presumed. I've had a long time to get used to it, you know."
The 2 boys said nothing for a few moments after that. Jean closed his book and stared up at the sky.
"You know, I might not even be one after all," Locke said. "A real orphan, I mean."
"How so?"
"Well, my mother's dead. I saw that. I know that. But my father, he went away when I was very little. I don't remember him. Never knew him."
"I'm sorry," said Jean.
"We're both sorry a lot, aren't we? I think he might have been a sailor or something. Maybe a mercenary, you know. Mother never wanted to talk about him. I don't know. I could be wrong."
"My father was a good man," said Jean. "He was... They both had a shop in North Corner. They shipped leathers and silks and some gems. All over the Iron Sea, some trips inland. I helped them. Not shipping, of course, but record-keeping, counting. And I took care of the cats. We had 9. Mama used to say... She used to say that I was her only child who didn't go about on all 4s.
He sniffled a bit and wiped his eyes.
"I seem to have used up all my tears," he said. "I don't know what to feel about all this any more. My parents taught me to be honest, that the laws and the gods abhor thieving. But now I find out thieving has its very own god, and I can either starve on the street or be comfortable here."
"It's not so bad," said Locke. "I've never done anything else, as long as I can remember. Thieving is an honest trade, when you look at it like we do. We can work really hard at it sometimes."
Locke reached inside his tunic and brought out a soft cloth bag.
"Here,"
he said, handing it over to Jean.
What's this?"
"You said you needed optics."
Locke smiled.
"There's a lens grinder over in the Videnza who's older than the gods. He doesn't watch his shop window like he ought to. I lifted some pairs for you."
Jean shook the bag open and found himself looking down at 3 pairs of optics. There were 2 circular sets of lenses in gilt wire frames and a square set with silver rims.
"Thank you, Locke.
He held each pair up to his eyes and squinted through them in turn, frowning slightly.
"I don't quite know. I'm not ungrateful, not at all, but none of these will work."
He pointed at his eyes and smiled sheepishly.
"Lenses need to be made for the wearer's problem. There's some for people who can't see long ways, and I think that's what these pairs are for, but I'm what they call close blind, not far blind."
"Oh, damn." Locke scratched the back of his neck and smiled sheepishly.
"I don't wear them. I didn't know. I really am an idiot." "Not at all. I can keep the rims and do something with them, maybe. Rims break. I can just set proper lenses in them. There'll be spares. Thank you again."
The boys sat in silence for a short while after that, but this time it was a companionable silence. Jean leaned back against the wall and closed his eyes. Locke stared up at the moons, straining to see the little blue and green specks Chains had once told him were the forests of the gods. Eventually, Jean cleared his throat.
"So you're really good at stealing things?"
"I have to be good at something. It's not fighting, and it's not mathematics, I guess."
Father Chains told me about this thing you can do if you pray to the benefactor. He called it a death offering. Do you know about that?"
"Oh," said Locke, "I know all about it. Truth of all 13 gods, cross my heart and pray to die."
"I'd like to do that, for my mother and my father, but I've never stolen anything. Can you maybe help me?"
"Teach you how to steal, so you can do a proper offering?"
"Yes."
Jean sighed.
"I guess if this is where the gods have put me, I should bend to local custom."
"Can you teach me how to use a numbers box so I look less like a half-wit next time?"
"I think so," said Jean.
"Then it's settled."
Locke jumped back up to his feet and spread his hands wide.
"Tomorrow, Carlo and Galdo can plant their arses on the temple steps. You and I will go out and plunder."
"That sounds dangerous," said Jean.
"For anyone else, maybe. For gentlemen bastards, well, it's just what we do."
"We?"
"We."
Chapter 6 Limitations 1 The red hands led Locke up the long gangway to the floating grave just as the scarlet sun broke above the dark buildings of the Ashfall district. The whole wooden waste turned to blood in that light, and when Locke blinked to clear the brightness from his eyes, even the darkness flashed with red. Locke struggled to keep his head clear. The combination of nervous excitement and fatigue always made him feel as though he was sliding along an inch or two above the ground, his feet not quite reaching all the way down. There were sentries on the quay, sentries at the doors, sentries in the foyer, more than there had been before. They were all grim-faced and silent as the red hands led Locke deeper into the Kappa's floating fortress. The inner clockwork doors weren't locked. Kappa Barsavi stood in the middle of his great audience chamber, facing away from Locke, his head bowed and his hands behind his back. Curtains had been drawn away from the high glass windows on the eastern side of the galleon's hull. Red fingers of light fell on Barsavi, his sons, a large wooden cask, and a long object that lay covered on a portable wooden bier.
"Father," said Andres, "it's Lamora."
Kappa Barsavi grunted and turned. He stared at Locke for a few seconds, his eyes glassy and dead. He waved his left hand.
"Leave us," he said. "Leave us now."
Heads down, Andres and Pachero hurried out of the room, dragging the red hands with them. A moment later the hall echoed with the sound of the doors slamming shut and the clockwork locks tumbling into position.
"Your Honor," said Locke, "what's going on?"
The bastard killed her, Locke. He killed Nazca last night, left us the body just a few hours ago."
Locke stared at Barsavi, dumbfounded, aware that his mouth was hanging open.
But she was here, wasn't she?"
"She left.
Barsavi was clenching and unclenching his fists. She snuck off, near as we can tell. Or she was taken. Second or third hour of the morning. She was returned at 4:30 the fourth hour of the morning.
Returned? By whom?
Come, see. Vencarlo Barsavi drew back the cloth that covered the bier, and there lay Nazca, her skin waxy, her eyes closed, her hair damp. Two livid purple bruises marred the otherwise smooth skin on the left side of her neck. Locke felt his eyes stinging, and he found himself biting down hard on the first knuckle of his right index finger. "See what the bastard has done," Barsavi said softly. "She was the living memory of her mother, my only daughter. I would rather be dead than see this." Tears began sliding down the old man's cheeks. "She has been washed."
"Washed? What do you mean?"
"She was returned," said the copper. "In that." He gestured to the cask, which stood upright a few feet to the side of the bier.
"In a barrel?"
"Look inside." Locke slid the barrel's cover back and recoiled as the full stench of the barrel's contents wafted out at him. It was full of urine, horse urine, dark and cloudy. Locke whirled away from the cask and clapped both hands over his mouth, his stomach spasming.
"Not just killed," said Barsavi, "but drowned. Drowned in horse piss."
Locke growled, fighting tears.
"I can't believe this. I just can't believe it. This doesn't make any fucking sense."
He moved back beside the bier and took another look at Nazca's neck. The purple bruises were actually raised bumps. Straight red scratches were visible just in front of them. Locke stared at them, thinking back to the feel of talons in his own skin. The injury on his forearm still burned.
"Your Honor," he said slowly, "maybe she was returned in that thing, but I'm pretty sure she didn't drown in it."
"What can you possibly mean?"
"The marks on her neck, the little scratches beside them?"
Locke extemporized, keeping his voice level and his face neutral. "What would sound plausible?"
"I've, seen them before. Several years ago in Talisham. I saw a man murdered by a scorpion hawk. Have you ever heard of such a thing?"
"Yes," said the copper. "An unnatural hybrid, some sort of creature dreamed up by the sorcerers of Carthane. Is that the marks on her neck? Can you be sure?"
"She was stung by a scorpion hawk," Locke said. "The talon marks beside the wounds are clear. She would have been dead almost instantly."
"So he merely pickled her afterward," Barsavi whispered. "To increase the insult, to cut me more cruelly."
"I'm sorry," said Locke. "I know it can't be much comfort."
"If you're right, it was a much quicker death." Barsavi pulled the cloth back up over her head, running his fingers through her hair one last time before he covered her completely. "If that is the only comfort I can pray that my little girl received, I will pray for it. That grey bastard will receive no such comfort when his time comes. I swear it."
"Why would he do this?"
Locke ran both of his hands through his hair, wide-eyed with agitation.
"It doesn't make any sense. Why her? Why now?"
"He can tell you himself," said Barsavi.
"What? I don't understand."
Kappa Barsavi reached into his vest and drew out a folded piece of parchment. He passed it over to Locke, who opened the fold and saw that a note was scribed there in a clean, even hand. "Barsavi, for the necessity of what was done, we apologize, though it was done to facilitate your understanding of our power, and therefore your cooperation. We earnestly desire a meeting with yourself, man to man, in all courtesy,
to settle once and for all between us this matter of Camor. We shall be in attendance at the Echo Hole, at the 11th hour of the evening, on the Duke's day 3 nights hence. We shall be alone and unarmed, though you, for your part, may bring as many counsellors as you wish, and you may arm them as you wish. Man to man, we may discuss our situation, and with the kind favour of the gods, perhaps abjure the need for you to lose any more of your loyal subjects, or any more of your own flesh and blood.
I don't believe it, said Locke. Meet in good faith after this?
He cannot be Camori, said Barsavi. I have become Camori in my years here. I am more of this place than many who were born here, but this man... Barsavi shook his head vigorously. He cannot understand what an infamy he has done to get my attention. What an insult my sons and I must bear if I negotiate with him. He wastes his time with this letter, and look, the royal we. What an affectation!
Your Honor, what if he does understand what he's done?
The possibility is very remote, Locke. The copper chuckled sadly, or else he would not have done it.
Not if you presume that the meeting at the Echo Hole is an ambush, that he wants to get you off the floating grave and into a place where he has prepared some real harm for you.
Your prudence again, Barsavi smiled without humour. The thought has occurred to me, Locke. But if he wanted me dead, why not strike from surprise months ago, before he started killing my garistas? No, I believe he genuinely thinks that if he frightens me enough, I will negotiate in good faith. I'm indeed going to the Echo Hole. We shall have our meeting, and for my counselors I will bring my sons, my Berangius sisters, and 100 of my best and my cruelest, and I will bring you and your friend Jean.
Locke's heart beat against the inside of his chest like a trapped bird. He wanted to scream.
Of course, he said. Of course. Jean and I will do anything you ask. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Good. Because the only negotiation we'll be doing is with bolt, blade, and fist. I've got a surprise for that grey piece of shit, if he thinks to dictate terms to me over the body of my only daughter.
Locke ground his teeth together. I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his, the Grey King had said.
Kappa Barsavi, said Locke, have you considered, well, the things they say about the Grey King? He can kill men with a touch, he can walk through walls... He can't be harmed by blades or by arrows.
Stories told in wine. He does as I did when I first took this city. He hides himself well and he chooses his targets wisely.
The copper sighed. I admit that he is good at it, perhaps as good as I was, but he's not a ghost.
There is another possibility, said Locke, licking his lips. How much of what was said here might reach the Grey King's ears? He'd unraveled the secrets of the gentleman bastards thoroughly enough. To hell with him.
The possibility of a bondsmage. Aiding the Grey King?
Yes.
He's been vexing my city for months, Locke. It might explain some things, yes, but the price. Even I could not pay a bondsmage for that length of time.
Scorpion hawks, said Locke, aren't just created by the Bonds Magi. As far as I know, only Bonds Magi themselves keep them. Could an ordinary falconer train a bird that could kill him with one accidental sting?
Bullshit well, he thought. Bullshit very well.
The Grey King wouldn't need to have kept one this whole time. What if the Bonds Mages newly arrived? What if the bondsmage has only been hired for the next few days, the critical point of whatever the Grey King's scheme is? The rumours about the Grey King's powers could have been spread to prepare for all of this.
Fantastical, said Barsavi, and yet it would explain much.
It would explain why the Grey King is willing to meet you alone and unarmed. With a bondsmage to shield him, he could appear both, yet be neither.
Then my response is unchanged.
Barsavi squeezed one fist inside the other.
If one bondsmage can best 100 knives, including you and I, my sons, my Barangia sisters, your friend Jean and his hatchets, then the Grey King has chosen his weapons better than I. But for my part, I do not imagine that he has.
You will keep the possibility in mind? Locke persisted.
Yes, I shall.
Barsavi placed a hand on Locke's shoulder.
You must forgive me, my boy, for what has happened.
There's nothing to forgive, Your Honor. When the Kappa changes the subject, thought Locke, the subject is finished. It wasn't your fault.
It is my war. It's me the Grey King truly wishes to cut.
You offered me a great deal, sir. Locke licked his lips, which had suddenly gone dry. I'd very much like to help you kill the bastard.
So we shall. At the 9th hour of the evening, on Duke's Day, we begin to gather. Andres will come to fetch you and Tannen at the last mistake.
What of the Sansas? They're good with knives.
And with cards, or so I hear. I like them well enough, Locke, but they're fiddlers, amusers. I'm taking serious folk for serious business.
As you say.
Now.
Barsavi took a silk handkerchief from his vest pocket and slowly mopped his brow and cheeks with it.
Leave me, please. Come back tomorrow night as a priest. I'll have all my other priests of the benefactor. We'll give her a proper ritual.
Despite himself, Locke was flattered. The Kappa had known that all of Father Chain's boys were initiates of the benefactor, and Locke a full priest, but he'd never before asked for Locke's blessing in any official sense. Of course, he said quietly. He withdrew then, leaving the Kappa standing in the bloody morning light, leaving him all alone at the heart of his fortress, for the second time, with nothing but a corpse for company. 2.
Gentlemen,
said Locke, huffing and puffing as he closed the door to the seventh-floor rooms behind him.
We have done our bit for appearances this week. Let's all work out of the temple until further notice.
Jean was sitting in a chair facing the door, hatchets resting on his thigh, with his battered old volume of the Corish romances in his hands. Bug was snoring on a sleeping pallet, sprawled in one of those utterly careless positions that give instant arthritis to all save the very young and foolish. The Sansas were sitting against the far wall, playing a desultory hand of cards. They looked up as Locke entered.
"We are released from one complication," said Locke, "and flung headlong into another. And this bitch has teeth."
"What news?" said Jean.
"The worst sort."
Locke dropped into a chair, threw back his head and closed his eyes.
"Nazca's dead." "What?"
Carlo leapt to his feet. Galdo wasn't far behind.
"How did that happen?"
"The Grey King happened. It must have been the other business he referred to when I was his guest. He sent the body back to her father in a vat of horse piss."
"Gods,"
said Jean. "I'm so sorry, Locke."
"And now," continued Locke, "you and I are expected to accompany the Kappa when he avenges her at the clandestine meeting 3 nights hence, which will be at the Echo Hole, by the way. And the Kappa's idea of clandestine is 100 knives charging in to cut the Grey King to bloody pieces."
"Cut you to bloody pieces, you mean?" said Galdo.
"I'm well aware of who's supposed to be strutting around wearing the Grey King's clothes, thanks very much. I'm just debating whether or not I should hang an archery butt around my neck. Oh, and wondering if I can learn to split myself in two before Duke's Day."
"This entire situation is insane,"